one for coming. This is this week is at a different time. I'm sorry for the inconvenience, and I apologize. I just couldn't do it at the regular time this week, but we'll be back next week, I hope, for the rest of the course to the Thursday time. I do have some good news for you. The lecture last week was probably the most difficult one in the course. We were dealing with dead weight loss and problems of utility theory. So I thought that was a bit difficult, I thought, at least I find it a bit difficult. So if you were able to get through that one, and I assume you all did since people are still here for the course, you'll find the rest of the lectures are rather easier, at least I intend them to be somewhat easier. Now today we're going to talk about wages. You recall in the Bible, there's a famous statement, the wages of sin is death. But that's not the sense of wages I'm going to be talking about. That's the notion of a theology of payment or getting your just desserts for sin. I don't have that in mind. I'm going to talk about ordinary wages in the sense of paying for labor services. That was supposed to be a joke, but I guess nobody thought it was funny. Okay, now, in the first two lectures, you remember, I kept stressing probably over and over again, I never repeat anything. You know, I never repeat anything. No, I never do. But the first two lectures, I stressed a number of times the contrast between Austrian economics and neoclassical or mainstream economics. Remember, neoclassical economics, I didn't really define it strictly. It's just the way, I mean by that, the way economics is taught in most major American, English, probably European departments, where it has some similarities to Austrian economics, but there are differences as well. So what I've been stressing in the first two lectures is Austrian economics is much easier, because in Austrian economics we just use reasoning in ordinary language from simple axioms like study the concept of action, things that we just understand in an ordinary common sense way, whereas in mainstream economics uses all sorts of mathematics. You need to construct models, and you have further mathematics to test these models. So what I've been doing so far in the lectures, I've contrasted the Austrian approach, which is very easy, with the mainstream approach, which is more difficult. But on wages, there's much less difference between the Austrian and mainstream approach. It's quite the conclusions here are quite similar, so you won't find, if you were to take a course in a university, regular university, not one specializing in Austrian economics, and you were taking dealing with wages, you wouldn't find much difference from what you would get in an Austrian approach. Now, one thing very important about wages, I think Henry Hazlitt in your reading selection for economics in one less makes a very fundamental point about wages. You'll think this is a very easy one, but if you can get it, you're able to understand the concept very much more readily than if you don't take this down. He says wages are a price, I think. The price of labor, when somebody's paying, say somebody's paying you $50 an hour to write his homework, do his homework for him, then the price of your service is $50. It's just wages are a price. So it may sound rather trivial, but what's important about it is that there isn't a separate theory about how wages are determined. Wages, it's just ordinary, if you ask how wages are determined, it's basically ordinary price theory. You don't have a separate way of figuring out what wages, how wages are determined. Now, some people overlook that. They'll think wages are somehow different. For example, we see a lot of people, and I'll be dealing with this a bit later in the lecture, a lot of people say, well, how do we make sure wages are high? People talk about minimum. People sometimes have minimum wage laws. They don't want wages to fall below a certain point. But it would be funny if people said, well, prices aren't high enough. What we want are high prices. You wouldn't expect people to say that, but somehow wages are supposed to be different. Again, it's generally in mainstream people think it's bad if businesses get together and try to get together and collude with each other. They agree to have high prices. They sort of agree that they won't compete with each other so they can raise prices. But people very often take that a different approach with labor. They say, well, it's a good thing unions agree not to bargain individually with the employer so they can keep wages high. So they take wages to be somehow different from ordinary prices, but in fact they're not. A wage just is a price. So if we say wages are prices, well, of course, this raises the immediate question. We want to figure out how are wages determined. We have to say, well, how are prices determined? Because wage is a price. Now, the basics of price determination, how price is determined, are very simple. Let's take an example. Suppose I have 5 apples, and I want to sell all these apples. So let's say I offer the prices for sale at $5 an apple. Now, I don't know how conditions are. I see people are here from various parts of the world. At least in the U.S., that would be an extraordinarily high price for an apple, $5 an apple. So I probably won't sell any. I said, well, I'm going to sell apples $5 an apple. People wouldn't buy apples. It reminded me of a story that there was a man who was sitting on a street corner. He had some pencils in a cup. And so somebody said that, how much do you want for a pencil? And he said $5,000. So the person said, well, you're not going to sell many pencils for $5,000 each. And he said, I know, all I need to do is sell one. So you see, what this joke is supposed to be showing is if your price is too high, your price is more than people want to pay, you're not going to sell any. So what would happen, say, I just don't know the conditions of the market. I just don't know the apple market. I start off with $5. I offer $5 an apple, then people don't buy them. So what would I do? Well, then I'll lower my price till I succeed in selling all the apples. Now, what would happen on the other hand? Suppose I set the price at 1 cent per apple, and we're assuming there isn't anything wrong with the apples. If not, they're not rotten apples. It's ordinary apples. So I set them at 1 price per apple. Then I'll probably find that people will want more than 5 apples. People will say, well, all these apples are available for 1 cent. You know, they'll be lining up to get the apples. So I only have 5 apples available at 1 cent. So somebody might say, well, okay, if you give me the apple instead of this other person, I'll give you 2 cents for an apple. And we could imagine that would still be a great buy, 2 cents for a good apple. So people will keep bidding up the price until it reaches a point at which people aren't clamoring for so many apples. People will say if the price rises sufficiently, people wouldn't be so anxious to get apples. They'll just demand the number of people demanding apples won't be more than the assets available. So we can see we have this process where if I ask too high a price and people won't buy, so I'll be lowering the price. And then if I don't ask very much, people will want the apples, will bid up the price. So we said, well, when will the price stabilize? When will it stop going either up or down? Well, we can see it's going to stabilize when all the apples are sold and there are no buyers who are willing to offer a higher price. See, all the apples are sold and nobody is willing to offer a higher price. So at this stable price, which is called the equilibrium price, we call that because somehow balance between quantity supply and quantity demand. The quantity of atoms of apples that are supplied, I say, that are sold, equals the quantity demanded, the quantity that's bought. So at the, very important, at the equilibrium price, quantity supplied equals quantity demanded. If the price is lower than that, then more people will, there'll be greater quantity demanded than is available. We'll have a shortage. If the price is higher than that, then we won't be able to sell all the apples. There'll be a surplus of apples. There'll be an equilibrium price at which quantity supplied equals quantity demanded. Now, when I've given the example so far, I just said I'm selling 5 apples. Now, what would happen if there are more people selling apples? Say, I'm not the only one selling apples. There's all sorts of other people selling apples at the same time. This wouldn't change things at all. We'd still have bidding between buyers and sellers. Would lead to a price at which whatever's offered for sale is bought. In fact, if you had more people selling and more people buying, that'll just speed up the process of reaching equilibrium price. I see somebody said, I'm trying to know how many $5,000 pencils the government owns. I guess that, I wonder if they, probably quite a few, I wonder if they probably include erasers too. Reminds me of this story, someone who referred to Occam's razor as Occam's eraser. It's actually quite a good philosophy who did that. But I think with a $5,000 pencil, you should at least get an eraser, don't you think? But getting back to equilibrium price, I see the concept is very easy. It's just that what the price is that you won't have more buyers who want the goods than there are quantities of the good available, and you won't have more of the good available than there are people who want to buy it. So, as I said before, just go over again, if there are goods that supply that people won't buy, like say my original case for apples, $5, that people don't want to pay that, then sellers are going to lower the price. I'd like to get $5 an apple, but it's not going to do me any good to ask that amount of money if people won't buy at that price, so I'll lower my price. And then if people want more of a good than is available, say the price I'm asking, a lot more people want apples than one of the 5 I have available, and there'll be a shortage, so then the price will go up. And as the price goes up, fewer people will want the apples. So we'll reach a point where quantity supply equals the quantity demand, and that's the equilibrium price. Now, there's an objection here. The way I presented it, this story is, people just bargain with each other to reach the equilibrium price. If, say, the price seems too high to people, they'll just offer they say, we don't want to pay this much, we'll offer a lower price, and the seller will, if he thinks the price is too high, he'll lower the price himself. So there'll be bargaining going on. Sometimes there is bargaining. Sometimes if you go into certain kinds of markets, you can bargain with people. If you go into a used, you're buying a used car, you can say to the dealer, well, I don't want to pay that much. How about $1,000 less? And you can get into it. You can have bargaining just the way I explained. But very often when you go into a store, it would be very unusual to bargain about the price. Say, suppose you're eating at McDonald's, you're probably not going to say to people, to the manager there, how about $1 off on the Big Mac? You just have to, you just take the price that they have. If you don't like it, you go somewhere else. So question then comes up, and this is the objection. Is it still true that supply and demand are determining price if you're not able directly to bargain about the price? So you just go into a market, you see various prices for things, so you have to pay that. Say, I buy a lot of books from Amazon online, so if I don't like the price they offer, I just don't buy that book. I probably wouldn't be very successful. If I email them and say, I don't want to pay $80 for this particular book, how about $2 instead? I wouldn't get anywhere. I just have to take whatever price they offer. So does this fact that sometimes, many times people just have to accept to reject the price that they find in the market, does that change the way prices are established in the market? Does it make any difference? Is it still true that supply and demand determine price? Well, yes, it is. You don't need actual bargaining to take place, and you can, I think, see pretty readily why not. Supposing McDonald's sets the price of Big Mac at a certain rate, say $3, and then they find that people don't buy all the Big Macs that they have. There are a lot of leftover Big Macs. So then they'll lower their price. And on the other hand, if they don't have enough to supply their customers, they'll raise their price. So even though there's no actual bargaining, they just make, based on what they sell, they can just make estimates of what the price should be, and they'll still reach the equilibrium price in that way. So even if you have particular people setting the price, that doesn't change the basic way prices are established. So now, what about wages? Well, you should be able to get from what I've said so far, where I explained how prices are determined by supply and demand. We're trying to reach the equilibrium price to get the quantity supplied equal to the quantity demanded. Is the wage rates are set. Remember I said a wage is the price. So if a wage is a price, and we know how prices are determined, then we know how wages are determined. It's exactly the same way as what I've said for prices. Remember, what are they selling? Just like I'm selling apples, a worker is selling his labor services, whatever he's doing there. Say, someone is doing all sorts of work. You can imagine for each kind of work, the worker in that occupation is selling a particular kind of labor service. And the employers, the people who pay them, are the buyers. So just the same as in apples or any other good on the market, the wage rate for a particular kind of labor will be set so the quantity supplied equals the quantity demanded at that price. So it's just like I mentioned with Apple. Supposing an employer offers something like, well, I want people to work on, I'm looking for auto mechanics and I'll pay $6 an hour. Now, at least in the U.S., he's not going to get very many takers at that price. So at that wage offer, the quantity supplied would be much less than the quantity demanded. A lot of employers would like to have an auto mechanic for $6 an hour, but there'd be very few, if any, who would be willing, mechanics would be willing to supply their labor at that rate. So we'd have at that rate, there would be a shortage. There wouldn't be, people would want much more auto mechanic services than would be available. So if people want to have an auto mechanic and they can't get the auto mechanic for $6 an hour, they have to raise the wage offer. They raise the price, and as they keep raising the price, then the demand for auto mechanics would be falling as the price, their wage goes up, and the supply would be increasing because more people will hire you. More money you offer, more people would want to work at that rate, and fewer people would be offering as the rate goes up. So you reach the point at which the quantity supply and quantity demanded were equal, and that would be the equilibrium wage. Now again, it doesn't matter if there's actual bargain. It doesn't matter if an employer meets with individual workers and the worker said, you're not offering, I don't want to work for you at that rate. I want $10 an hour more than you're offering. It doesn't matter because, say, in many businesses, they'll just offer a certain wage. You can either take it or leave it. But that doesn't change the way wages are determined because if the employers don't offer high enough wages to get as many workers as they want, they'll have to raise their offer. And similarly, if their offer is, if they're offering a certain amount and they get more people willing, say they offered the, I'm offering, let's say there's a job open at McDonald's, I'm managing McDonald's, so I offer $100 an hour to people who work at McDonald's, so they're going to be lining up around the block to try to get a job there. So people will then, some of them will say, well, I'll work for you for only $50, and the wage will be put down. So the wages will, again, just like other prices, will reach a point at which quantity of labor demanded equals the quantity supplied. Now, some people don't really strongly object to the way I've been explaining wages. It isn't that they consider the way that I'm particularly inarticulate, doing a bad job. That's a different question. What I mean is they don't like the theory I've been giving. I say wages are just wage established just like other prices. There's an equilibrium between quantity supplied and quantity demanded. Some have given an objection like this, which is called the bargaining power objection. And they say, suppose you have imagine an individual worker he's working for a very large company. He said, well, this individual worker has no bargaining power. What do they mean by that? Let's suppose someone doesn't have particular skills, very many skills, is the only job he has available is, say, working for the Walmart, say, loading boxes when they're delivery. That's the only kind of work he's really suited to do. And so let's say it's the only job available. Let's assume there aren't any welfare benefits available. So this is the only thing available to him. Either he takes that job unloading boxes for Walmart, or he doesn't get anything. So if he, suppose he loses this job, then he would face starvation, because remember, we're assuming no welfare benefits, and that's the only job available to him. So he's really very, pardon power objection run, he's really very dependent on the job. If he loses the job, he's really had it. Let's look at the situation from the point of view of Walmart. They could easily hire somebody else in his place. They don't need him. So the objection runs, well, doesn't he have to accept whatever Walmart offers him? Even if it's very little money, it's kind of a, just a pittance, doesn't he have to take it? What choice does he have? So people say, well, isn't this very unfair that the worker really doesn't have any power? So the way I've been, explaining wages so far, I say they're just like any other price where you have some kind of bargaining, whether it's explicit bargaining or just implicit estimates of supply and demand. We say this is wrong because it isn't that we have some sort of process by which quantity demanded equals quantity supplied. It's just the employee, because he's had so weak, has to take whatever is offered to him. Many people attack large businesses. They'll say the workers are really at their mercy. Now, I don't think this objection really to standard price theory really works, because it's true that Walmart could easily get along without this particular worker. But remember, Walmart is in competition with other firms, both large ones and small ones, that hire unskilled labor. So if it offers substandard wages, suppose they say, suppose the standard wage, let's say, is $15 an hour for doing this unloading boxes, and they say, well, we're only going to get $5 an hour, other firms will tend to bid their workers away. So even though it's quite true an individual worker really couldn't do much when faced with a very large firm, wouldn't have very much influence on them, say the worker said, I don't want to work at your wages, so they could just tell them, you know, fine, we'll just get somebody else. But they couldn't do that as long for, if they could do that for one particular worker, but they couldn't do that for workers as a whole, because then they'd lose their workers to other firms. So that the individual really isn't at the mercy of the large company as long as there's competition. I think that there's a, somebody has a comment here. Now somebody raised a point that the effects of welfare on this, I think we could get into in the question period. You're right that the basic point in the question was that if you have a welfare system, then the wages have to be above that welfare in order to get people to work. Say if you could, suppose you could earn, say, $200 a week on welfare, then it wouldn't be in your interest to have to work for less than that, because we've got that for doing nothing. So it's quite true that that could act as a minimum wage, but I think we'll deal with that in the question, because it's a very good point you made. But so anyway, what I was saying was, as long as the firm, the large firm, is in competition with other firms, then it's not the case they really have these individual workers at their mercy, because they don't just hire one worker, they hire whole groups of workers. If they offer substandard wages, then their wages, their workers will be bid away. So I think we can understand this better by thinking of, let's say, imagine a buyer who offers an exceptionally low price for an apple. Let's say, again, I'm selling apples, and somebody comes up and says, I'll give you 1 cent for the apple. Well, I'm not going to sell to him. So what's the analogy here is that the buyer is the employer, so the employer is offering a low wage, people won't sell to him. Now, why wouldn't I take accept the offer for a penny? Because I can go to someone, another buyer, who's willing to pay more. So you see the same point here. As long as there's competition, individual workers don't have to accept extraordinarily low wages, because other people, other employers, will bid, make higher bids for them. If the employer says, well, I can just offer some low amount, he won't get many takers, as long as people, other people, can compete for the worker's services. Now, one mistake to avoid in thinking about this question of thinking about the bargaining power of the workers and the individual workers faced with big firms, they think, well, I'm just one individual, what could I do against Walmart or General Motors? But remember, we mentioned this in the first two lectures, I stress this point, still true. Remember, if I say something in the first two lectures, it can still be true in the third lecture, even later lecture. Remember, the Austrian view of competition. An industry is competitive as long as there's free entry and exit into the industry. And remember also that all products are competing for money from the consumer. So what we have to key point to remember here is that this is where Austrian economics, this is one place Austrian economics is different from the mainstream, is the normal rules of price formation we just explained, where it's explaining supply and demand, how the quantity supplied for the good will, in the equilibrium, equal the quantity demanded. That applies as long as there's competition in the Austrian sense, namely that there's free entry and exit. It isn't dependent on competition in some different sense. They have to have a whole lot of small firms. The Austrian view, you have competition even if they're very large firms, they're still in competition with each other. So this is the basic mistake to avoid, with thinking, well, because they're large firms and we don't really have competition, so then you say, well, if they're not competition, then the worker faced with a large firm is really a large firm's mercy, because what could, say, one person do against Walmart? See how the basic flaw there is thinking, for competition, we need to have small firms, not large firms. But in the Austrian view, that isn't true, as long as we have firms that are in competition, since they're all trying to get the consumer's dollar, or all the ones in the same industry can, the people can get into the industry if they can raise enough capital to do so, they're free to do that. Then we have competition, and the ordinary rules of price formation apply. Now, what we've said so far is they're saying wages are is a price, and the price is determined in the same way as other prices, so that the quantity supply equals the quantity demanded. That's how you get the equilibrium price. But can we go further than this if we're trying to analyze what's, when we analyze how wages are determined? Say, what determines how much labor is demanded? We know that once we know what the demand is, then we can figure out how much, what would we say the demand, people say that we're willing to pay, say, $20 an hour for your auto mechanics, then we could get the demand, then we would ask how much would be supplied, how many auto mechanics would we get at that price, and if we know that, we can figure out what the equilibrium price would be. We could just either have to raise or lower the rates depending on what the circumstances were. But suppose we ask, well, what determines how much labor is demanded? How do we know that? Now, here again, we can reason very common sense way. Let's say an employer will want to hire a worker so long as the worker is contributing at least a little more to the value of the product than what he's paying him. Supposing, say, let's take the auto mechanic, supposing the auto mechanic is contributing $25 an hour to the value of the auto he's fixing, so it would be in my interest to pay him $20 because I'm getting more than I'm paying. So in trying to figure out what wage will be demanded, what I have to try to figure out is what value will the worker be contributing to the product. Now, one thing to realize when we're trying to figure this out is as more workers are hired, say, so you keep, imagine you have an auto mechanic, you keep hiring more and more auto mechanics. As you hire more workers for a particular service, their value tends to decrease. Why is that? Well, this is an instance, I say, the fact that the value of the workers decreases as you hire more, an instance of a more general economic law, which is called the law of diminishing marginal returns. So let me give you an example of that. Suppose, which I think is the case, to produce a car, you need labor. You have to have people working on the assembly line, plus various kinds of machines. You have the assembly line, various things will be going down the assembly line, the workers will be doing things to put the car together. Shows you about that's all I know about cars. I hope that's right. I don't drive myself, it's much too hard. I don't know anything about it. I can get that. I'm pretty safe in thinking that's what's going on. Now suppose you hold one of these facts, the production constant. Say you don't change the amount of labor you have, or you don't change the amount of machine, you hold one constant. You can't keep getting more and more cars just by adding to the other one. For example, suppose it takes a certain number of workers to operate a machine. So you can't say, well, I'm just going to hire double that number of workers that keep just stick with that one machine. You won't, if you keep doing that, you won't keep getting increases in your total production. You'll eventually get to a point where adding more workers won't do you any good as long as you just have that one machine. So you can't just holding, you have several factors, several things required to do something. If you hold them constant and just keep changing one of the factors, eventually you'll reach a point where you'll be getting less and less of a return just by increasing this one thing you didn't change. So make sure we got that again. Imagine you're keeping the machines the same, not adding to the machine. You keep adding more and more workers. So the value that you're getting from the workers will eventually go down. And similarly, you can do it the other way. If you keep the number of workers the same and just keep adding more and more machines, well, if you add too many machines, you won't be able, the workers won't be able to do much or anything with them. They'll just be, they can only operate a certain number of machines at one time. So if you keep adding machines again, you won't increase the productivity after that, you won't increase the value. If you hold one constant, you can't just keep increasing the other one and keep increasing the value. You'll eventually reach a point where the value is diminishing or getting less. So my ask, well, how, what about a company like Walmart? I seem to be picking on Walmart a lot in this lecture, but what about a company that just sells goods rather than produces them? Walmart doesn't, I don't think, maybe I'm wrong about this, they don't manufacture goods, they just put them on sale. So how does this law of diminishing returns apply there? Well, let's imagine that Walmart just kept hiring sales clerks, but didn't expand the store. They just kept hiring more and more sales clerks. So eventually, the sales clerk would just get in each other's way. You would have just people running around the store. They wouldn't, it wouldn't be that, well, if you hired more sales clerks, that just means you can help more people, so you'd be doing better business, so people wouldn't have to wait in line so much. That would be true for a while, but if you just kept hiring more and more and you didn't expand the store, then they get in each other's way. Here's an example of how law of diminishing marginal returns would apply into a business that isn't manufacturing, but you see, it can still apply, because in the way I just explained. Now, when we talk about diminishing marginal returns, you remember, sounds a little like diminishing marginal utility, but there's a basic difference between law of diminishing marginal returns and law of diminishing marginal utility. Remember, when we talk about diminishing marginal utility, the utility of a new unit is always less than that of the previous units. Remember, this is a question I think on one of the quizzes. And the reason for that is when you get a good, you're going to devote your first unit of good to your highest value use. So if you get a new unit of good, what you put it to use for will be less value than before, because you're going to pick your highest value use first, and you'll go down the list. So marginal utility, diminishing marginal utility is always getting lower. Now, diminishing marginal returns doesn't have to be that way. Remember what I said was, if you hold factory production constant, like you don't keep the machines the same, but just keep adding workers, you'll eventually get to a point where adding more and more workers won't do increase the productivity. But I didn't say it has to be immediately that adding more and more workers will diminish the productivity. You could have cases where adding workers will increase the productivity a lot more than before. All this law says is eventually that will not be the case. Eventually you have diminishing marginal returns. So you could have increasing returns for a while, but that'll stop and you'll get diminishing returns if you keep it up enough. So Now, what does all this have to do with wages? Well, we know then that as more workers are hired, their marginal revenue product will go down. I said we could get increasing returns for a while, but eventually we won't. The marginal revenue product will go down. So the marginal revenue product is what determines the wage rate. I said how much the new worker will add to the value of product is going to determine how much wages the employer will offer. Now, obviously, the employer won't offer higher wages and won't offer more than the marginal revenue product, because then you would be paying more than the worker contributes to the product. So I think that, say, hiring someone to write this lecture for me is worth $50 to me. So I'm not going to pay him $60 to write the lecture because that's more than it's worth to me. Now, so I won't offer, the employer won't offer more than the marginal revenue product. Now, what if he offers much less than that? Well, it would be to his advantage to hire workers up to the point that the wage is just slightly below the marginal product. Because as long as he does that, he's still making something from the worker. So you will tend to find that the wages are not very much different from the marginal revenue product. Now, one thing to notice here is that all the workers get the marginal wage. So even if the, say, imagine the same employer has a large number of workers, if he had a few workers, they would be having higher marginal revenue product. Yeah, they get more and more, and the marginal revenue product is lower. And that doesn't just apply to the new workers. That's what he pays all of them, because that's all. Why is that? Well, because that's all a worker is worth to him with that number of workers. It doesn't matter whether the worker was hired first or later. That's all with that number of workers, that's all the worker is worth, so that's what the worker will get approximately. Now, sometimes people object to the marginal productivity theory of wages. And what is the objection? Well, according to this, remember, the worker is supposed to get what he's contributing to the product. What is he contributing, the marginal revenue, what he's contributing to the product. So they say, well, that's all very well if you could figure out how much each factor production contributes to the value of the product. But how are you supposed to do that? All you know is if you get all the factors production together, you'll get the product. But how are you able to determine what is the contribution of each one? For example, suppose, let's get back to Walmart again. How much did the sales clerk contribute to Walmart's revenue? Well, you know, if there weren't any sales clerks, they wouldn't be able to sell anything. But how do you know how much the sales clerk contributes as opposed to all the other things they have in store, having all the products there that contributes to their revenue, or how much is due just to the activity of the sales clerk? Well, in spite of this objection, very often people can tell what the particular factor contributes to the product. And how do they do that? Well, they can see what that same factor production earns in other uses. So we could say, how much would sales clerks earn in other businesses if they weren't working for Walmart? And this gives you a rough idea of what the they're contributing to Walmart. You think, well, if they were in some other firm, this is what they'd be getting. So this gives you some idea of what they're getting in this one. So that works as long as the particular factor of production, in this case workers, can shift from one firm or one industry to another. So you can see what they'd be getting in the alternative uses, and this can help you figure out what they're contributing to this particular product. I should warn you, if you look at Mankind and State, Rothbard's great book, you can see that figuring out what their revenue product is, marginal revenue product, can get very complicated, but this is what we're concerned here is just the basic idea. Now, when we're talking about marginal revenue product, we have to realize this does not mean just what the worker contributes to the product just by his own effort. So it isn't just what he's doing by himself. We're trying to figure out, well, what is this person just doing on his own to contribute to the value of the product. Let's imagine the employer puts in new machines in his factory, and this enables a worker to produce more. Then the worker's marginal revenue product has gone up. So even though it doesn't mean that the worker's skill level is risen, it might not have. Say the new method might require even less skill than before. But when we're talking about marginal revenue product, what we're talking about is what is the employer, the employee, the worker, able to contribute to the value of the product given the equipment he's working on. So it isn't just what he's contributing by himself, it's what he's contributing given that he's working with certain equipment. So the worker benefits from the investment of the employer. Let's say somebody's working as a clerk, and the employer puts in some powerful new computer, and then the person is able to get much more done. So even though the worker isn't responsible for the computer, he's just been using this because the employer's put it in there, he still gets the benefit because he's now more productive in that he's working on that machine. Now, as you will suspect from the way I organize these lectures, there's an objection to this. I like giving objections to everything, so as you can imagine, there's an objection to this. And this objection was raised by a man named David Schweikart, who's a philosopher and economist. Teaches at the Loyola University of Chicago. And he said, and he objected to using the point I've just made about workers' productivity as an argument for the free market. Sometimes people who like the free market will say, well, in the free market, great, because look, these workers aren't responsible for the machines. They're just benefiting because the machine raises their productivity, and then they get higher wages. That makes them, working on the machine makes them more valuable. Well, that's not due to some quality, they're being more valuable. It isn't due to some quality of their own. It's just they're able to, the employers put in these machines, and that raises their value. So isn't it great? It doesn't show how great the free market is, because the workers can benefit from this. So what Schweikart says is, if you say the worker's benefiting from the machinery and tools we haven't created, then why are the tools and machinery owned by a separate group of employers? Why aren't they owned by the workers? He says, well, you say the workers are benefiting from using the machine, but why should the machines belong to the employers? Why don't they belong to the workers? then they do even better, because then they'd own the machine. They would get all the benefits from not just what the employer gives them. Now, the response is, I think this ignores the fact that workers in a free market can set up their own businesses if they want to do that. So if particular workers want to set up their own businesses, they're free to do that. In some cases they do, but in many other cases they prefer to let others take the risks of investment. But in any case, if you don't like that answer, of course I like it because it's the one I just given. I wouldn't give you a response I didn't like. But the objection doesn't, the Schweikert says, well, the workers don't own the machine, that doesn't affect the point that workers' wages benefit from increases in machinery and tools, because these increases in machinery and tools of various kinds increases their margin revenue product. Now, one point that we'll just touch on, but it's a bit more advanced, I don't want to go into the details of it, that I haven't told the strict truth. It isn't that workers get the marginal revenue product, but what they actually get is not the full marginal revenue product, but the marginal revenue product discounted, reduced by the rate of interest. And I say we don't have to go into all the details here, but the basic reason they get discounted at marginal revenue product is that the employer has to pay the workers before he can sell the product and make money. So the employer is really advancing the money to the workers before he gets paid. So that's why you have to take account the rate of interest. And I say this is, for our purposes, just the detail that we don't have to bear in mind. We don't really have to concentrate on that. Now, what happens if the government enacts a minimum wage law? I say wages can't go below a certain amount. Well, from what we said about prices, we should be able to figure this out right away. If the minimum wage rate is above the market rate for certain kinds of labor, anyone worth less than that, the employer won't be employed. And you can see why not. Well, supposing there's a minimum wage rate of $10 an hour. Well, suppose I'm an employer and somebody's only worth $8 an hour to me, that's his marginal revenue product. I'm not going to be able to pay him $10. So minimum wages create an artificial surplus of labor, because at the minimum wage rate, there'll be more people who want to work at that rate than there is a demand for them. Employers won't want that, will want fewer workers at the minimum wage rate than people willing to work at that rate. There'll be a surplus of labor, just like any other price. Let's take this example where suppose there's a minimum price of $5 an apple. Well, there'll be a lot of people who want to sell apples at $5, but very few buyers. So there'll be a surplus of apples. So it's the same with minimum wages. If the minimum wage is above the market price for a particular kind of labor, there'll be more workers who are willing to take that minimum wage than there are employers who are offering it. Now, suppose minimum wages cause unemployment in the way I just explained. Does it follow that minimum wages are bad and that we should get rid of them? What we have to realize there is that that's an ethical judgment and doesn't follow from economic analysis. Economics, again, is just telling us what will happen, not what ought to happen. So it just says, well, this is going to cause unemployment. whether unemployment is good or bad is something that is an ethical judgment. However, this is, I think, a very important contribution Mises made, is we can say, without making any ethical judgment, we can say from the point of view of those who favor minimum wage laws that we can say, well, these laws won't achieve their purpose or their full purpose, because people who favor minimum wage laws say, well, we want them to raise the wage of labor, but they don't want unemployment, so they won't be getting that. So we can say, without making ethical judgment that minimum wage laws are bad, we can say they're not going to achieve all the purposes of those who favor them. Now, you might think minimum wages aren't that important. Now, in the U.S., I think the current federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. And most people earn substantially more than that. That wouldn't be very good money. So you might think, well, even if minimum wages cause unemployment for some people, say particularly teenagers or very unskilled workers, you might think, well, they're not that important because most people earn more than that. But one thing to remember, though, is that a worker's salary, what you're getting, includes not just your money you get, but all the benefits you get on the job. And sometimes laws impose requirements about these. For example, so you get health insurance, retirement benefits, sick leave. These are part of your wage or your salary. Also, if you have laws that say you have to have certain benefits, that can cause unemployment, because those laws say you have to have certain benefits act as minimum wage laws. Because you say employer can't say, well, I want to give it. Hire somebody, I don't want to give them health insurance, the law says you have to do that, then that's in effect a minimum wage. And I think we can see one effect of minimum wage laws, if I'm sure you're familiar, that we find in many professions there's a rise of unpaid interns. Say college students will work in the summer, kind of interning a job, say in the offices, various kinds of get experience working in these offices. So why are they not paid? You might think, well, isn't what they're doing at least worth something to the employer? But the employer can't offer below minimum wages to young people entering the job market. So what the employer has to do is say, well, okay, we can't offer you minimum wage, but you know, your services are worth something to us, but we'll just say, if you want to get the experience, you can work for free. Now, let's suppose they could offer below minimum wages to these interns. So if we imagine the interns are doing valuable work, then employers would, we could see, would offer money to kind of lure away the interns from their competitors, and then payment kind of competition would rise until the interns were earning the discounted marginal revenue product. So we can see how the minimum wage law, we could plausibly conjecture, are responsible for this rise of the intern program of people working for free. Now, from what we said about minimum wages, we can figure out what will happen if we have labor unions, say, try to say, organize workers in a particular firm or particular industry and say, we want such and such a wage for our workers. Now, just like we just explained in minimum wages, if the labor union gets a wage increase for its members that's above the market wage, then the employer will either have to cut the staff or not hire as many new workers as he otherwise would. I see somebody has a joke. My friends with benefits are strongly prefer the laws about benefits. So, well, that's a very good point. Yes, I quote, I couldn't give that, I couldn't have said that myself, I'd have to wash my mouth out with soap, and I don't want to do that. So the workers, what would happen is that the workers who would have been employed at the market rate, say we didn't have a labor union, workers would have been employed at the market rate, but now those workers can't get a job at the market rate because the labor unions are, our members have to get higher than market rate. So those workers have to try to seek jobs elsewhere. And when they do that, say they're going into other firms, they're increasing the supply of workers in seeking those other jobs, so they're driving down the wages in those other jobs because there's more of them than there would be otherwise. So even though the workers that the labor union is helping are getting more than the market wage, it's reducing wages for those who have to seek jobs elsewhere because there are more of those workers than before, so they're lowering the wage rate in those other firms or industries. Sometimes labor union bargaining over wages is defended in this way. People say, well, even though, in the way I explained, the market tends toward an equilibrium price, market conditions don't strictly fix this price. It isn't that there's a single price for the whole market. For example, if you look at gasoline prices, suppose you look at the price of gasoline at stations within a few miles of each other, you'll find they vary by a few cents. Usually you can get, like, say, I was just noticing, you'll find that around where I'm living, I see there's one that's offering gasoline at $3.89 a gallon, and there's somebody else's $3.93 or something. There's more variance there. So what union advocates say, they say, well, there's what they call a zone of indeterminacy, because the market won't determine the exact wage rate, the zone within which bargaining can help. So they're saying, well, our wage bargains aren't raising the price of labor, the wage above the market rate necessarily, because there isn't an exact market rate. There's a zone within which we're free to bargain. But there isn't much evidence that these zones exist, or to the extent they do exist, that workers without unions would end up in the worst part of the zone. So there doesn't appear to be that much in the zones of indeterminacy argument. Now, last point I want to mention is just one from the lecture last time that I don't think I explained too well, at least not as well as I'd like. It was one of the objections I had to neoclassical monopoly theory. Now remember, in the neoclassical theory, there's a diagram. I didn't draw this diagram, but take my word for it, there is such a thing. It, in the standard view, they can show that monopoly price results in a dead, what's called dead weight loss. And the gain to the monopolist from having monopoly price is less than what the consumers lose by having to pay a higher price. And you can show this geometrically. You can show that the gain to monopolist occupies less sort of space than the loss to the consumers. So you have, you get the dead weight loss. So the problem, the objection here is not there's something wrong with the way they drew the diagram, it's just how is the diagram to be interpreted? What are these boxes supposed to show? Now if you take them to make the dollar amounts, you can make sense of this. You can say, well, what the monopolist is gaining in dollars is less than what the consumers are losing in dollars. But the problem is if you say you're showing this diagram is supposed to show a utility loss. And to do that, you have to take utility to be some certain quantity. It doesn't mean you have to think you can measure utility, but you would have to make sense of the notion of increases or decreases in total utility. You'd have to make sense. if you're going to say these boxes represent utility, because what you'd be saying there is you'd say, well, if I can't measure utility in terms of exact units, I can still say, show that utility is going up or down, is less or more under certain circumstances. But if you took this very Austrian view where all you're doing is ranking good, it's difficult to see how you could make any sense of that. So that was the objection from before. I hope that makes it clear, at least doesn't muddy the water further. So I think we'll have questions now and the rest of the time. Wait, I saw, did someone have a, so what I'll do now is I'll just click on this, I click on the Q&A button, is that right? And that's supposed to open up this Q&A box, and I'll be able to see it, and then you can type in your questions if you have any. Okay, so let's see what the first one, is from Christy. Can you go over this measurement of contribution of a worker as a factor of production? Say, give us an example. Supposing, well, the case, it's sometimes these are very hard to figure out. Suppose you say something like, how much there's a particular auto mechanic who works for you, say you have a gasoline station, you have various auto mechanics who work for you, say how much is one particular worker contributing to your company? Well, one way you could do it, say you can figure out, well, what would he be earning if he were in a different company? So you could think, well, probably his contribution would be similar to there to what it is here. So if you can get his contribution in some other company, then this will give you at least some idea of what he's contributing in this one. So as they say there, as I mentioned, if you look at Rothbard's book, you see it's very often very difficult to do this. You see the basic problem is you know that all the actual deductions, meaning the worker and machine, together are giving you the total product. So it's hard to figure out what each one is doing. So the basic point, the key thing is, if the factor deduction isn't what they call totally specific to a particular firm, if they supposing there was some worker who could only work for your firm and couldn't do anything elsewhere, that would be very difficult to figure out what he should be getting. But if the worker can go elsewhere, that gives you some way of figuring out what he could do in other places. Now, we have one from Doug Jones. Is why are wages so sticky? During high unemployment, why don't wages go down precipitously, at least to the minimum wage, so that we're all employed? Sometimes that will vary. Sometimes what would be good answer, employers sometimes don't want to lower wages too much because they think this might be bad for the morale of the workers. So they don't do this. Very often there's government pressure on them not to do that. So again, it might be that also thing to remember is sometimes, say, an unemployed worker will think, well, if I just wait around a while, wages, or I'll be able to get something. Workers don't always want to work at a lower wage. I'll think, well, I think if I can wait out a while, then I'll be able to get a better job. So one thing I think to remember, whatever people decide to do in the market is the way they've chosen to adjust. So sometimes people say, when you talk about sticky wages, they'll have in mind some standard by which wages or other prices should change. They say, well, wages aren't changing fast enough, but you have to be careful about imposing some kind of standard on the market other than what the market participants themselves are deciding on. So the notion of a sticky wage is a bit problematic, you see, because it's suggesting there's something, as long as it's, there isn't interference with the way people in the market are doing things, of course, there very often is interference, but if there isn't, then however people decide to adjust it the way they want to do it. Now, another question from Doug is, if a new technology increases productivity, what would prevent employers from simply reducing price accordingly, not passing on an increase in wages to employees? Thus, technology would increase unemployment but decrease overall price of goods. Well, let's suppose an employer, that's a very good question. Let's suppose an employer decides, really, if I've got this new machine, why don't I get all the benefit from it myself? Why should I let the workers in on anything? Well, what happens though if some other person has the machine and says, well, I could use these workers on this new machine, I'd do even better, so I'll offer a little more money than this other guy who's trying to get at all the benefits himself. So again, competition will tend to raise the wage so that they're getting the discounted margin revenue product. And if the employer tried to do that, he probably wouldn't be very successful at it. As long as there was competition, he would have a lot of difficulty in doing the strategy you suggest. He might try to do it, but it would be very difficult to sustain that. Okay. Let's see. I still have some. Oh, here's one from Leslie. Leslie asks, could we be stuck at high levels of unemployment with neoclassical policy? Because even though wages are allowed to fall, malinvestments are not liquidated, and the government expands the money supply, leading to continued malinvestment. Yes, that's a very good thing. I mean, sometimes that would be more of a, I think, a Keynesian policy, sort of the government is increasing, it could be a monetarist view, the government is increasing the money supply, and you'd have the business cycle getting started again. That's a very good point. I didn't get into that in the lecture, not doing Austrian business cycle theory. That's a more advanced topic, but you're quite right. That could very well happen. That's a very good course. Yes, that's more advanced than we're doing in this course. Maybe you should be teaching this course instead. We're just doing the easy things here, which I try to make a little more difficult. Well, I shouldn't say I try to make it more difficult and stand up that way in my lectures. I wish it didn't. Now, Chrissy says, utility cannot be lost at all. I'm not understanding, Chrissy, what exactly do you mean by that? I'm not understanding the question. Could you be a bit, give me a bit more on this, what you mean? In what circumstances do you think utility can't be lost? Oh, I see what you mean. You're thinking that suppose you're just ranking goods in order. So you say, well, how can you talk about a utility loss if you're just making a list, a rank ordering of goods? Well, what you would call loss in utility is just say you're going to a lower rank on your list, say, supposing, let's say, what would be an example, suppose I I have different goods that I own. Say I have a particular book I value the highest, then there's the second highest book. Say I lose my top book, then I've lost the highest, I've lost utility, I've lost the number one items, I've gone to a second. When I would say, when I'm questioning the utility loss, I'm taking this in the sense that what you're doing is trying to, what this classical view is trying to say, we're getting some sort of a quantity of something apart from the particular goods and saying we can see that one quantity is higher than, or less than another. And that's the sense in which I think is questionable from the Austrian view. It isn't that a particular quantity utility in the Austrian view isn't a particular quantity. It isn't that we're saying, well, there's this quantity there, we somehow can't measure it because it's all subjective. We don't think there is any quantity to measure, but it doesn't follow from that there's no quantity to measure. The notion of utility loss doesn't make sense because we can still make sense of that in terms of ranking. It's an excellent question you ask. It's just we're talking about loss in the sense of something, some quantity that you can measure. That's the sense of loss we don't have in Austrian economics. That doesn't mean we're getting rid of the notion of gains or loss in utility altogether. It's a rather subtle point, but I think you can see the difference there, I hope. What is my top book? Well, that's a very tough question. I mean, I think there'd be different ones in different fields. I think in economics, you'd have to go with Human Action would be the best one. Man, Economy, and States right up there, you know. It would just depend on which field it was. Which do you have a top book? Oh, you like Human Action. Well, it's a good book. I remember when I first read Human Action, it was a very long time ago. I was in junior high at the time. I remember it very well. Okay, let's see, we still have a few more minutes here. What's my view on so-called Veblen goods? See, that's a very good question. It's also called a Giffinger. Now, I think this would be a good. Let's what I've said so far in kind of standard price theory. So if we raise the price of a good, then people want less of it, but there are some goods that people apparently buy more of if the price is higher, these kind of special prestige goods. Supposing what would be a case of, well, supposing you have there some extremely expensive watches, I think there's one called Philippe Patek, it's about $10,000 or more than that, a watch, probably more than that. So one of the reasons people buy these goods is they just want to show how much money they have. So they say, well, you know, I can afford this extremely expensive item. So one of the things they're looking for in this watch is that it's much more expensive than anything else, any other watch. That's why they're buying it. So in that case, the high price of the good is part of the attraction of the good. So that's really why high-priced goods could, in some cases, people would want more of it. And say if they were say it were just priced much less, then it would just be one kind of nice-looking watch along with other objects. Funny nice-looking watch. But it's the very fact that it's higher priced makes some people attracted. So then we would have to say that that contradicts ordinary price theory. No, we would have to say that, remember, what the good is just the good as people are taking. So one of the defining characteristics of the good is that it has a high price. That would be part of the good itself. Whereas in standard price theory, the price of the good isn't one of the characteristics of the good. It's something, you say, well, what are we looking for? Say we were buying a book. For most books, we're not looking for a high price. That's just something we have to pay for. Just what we want in a book is just certain content of the book. We don't care about the price is part of what we're looking for. Now, we could have books that have this quality. We say some people want to buy very rare books, and what attracts them to them is just that they have an extremely high price. And most goods don't have that quality to them. And this was named after Veblen's, V-E-B-L-I-N, Thorstein Veblen, who was a late 19th, early 20th century economist, who wrote about what he called conspicuous consumption. He was saying that rich people want to have certain goods. They buy certain things just to show how rich they are. They're really not very much used to it, but they just buy these goods to kind of show how rich they are. So that's why they're called Veblen goods. You know, some judging that you comprehend all of mankind's state and human action when we were in middle school. I don't think I made that first page when I was at it. Well, I can't say I understand all of them even now that I'm senior, but I was basically able to get through them. I'm sure I didn't understand a lot of what was going on, but, you know, it seemed like good stuff. So, I mean, you know, you have to read it. That was back in the old, that was a very long time ago. You know, when Mankind and State came out, I got it when it came out in 1962. That was a long time ago. No, unfortunately, I don't. Someone persuaded me to sell it to them. I wish I still had it, but I don't. I shouldn't have sold it to the person, but I don't forget exactly why I did, but I think I was kind of, somebody really wanted it, and I agreed to sell it, but I shouldn't have. Came in two, the original edition came in two volumes, sold for $20. 1962 was published by Van Nostrand Company. It had a green and white dust jacket. Okay, do we have anybody last question? Anybody have anything else? I'm going on strike so I can get my minimum wages. Now power and market, that came out somewhat later, but that was published, I think, a few years later. That was published by the Institute for Humane Studies. That was several years later that came out. I got that when it came out. That came out originally, I think, as a paperback. I remember that one. That was several years later. And of course, Ethics of Liberty came out quite a bit later. I think that came out in around 1980 or so, because I did a little work on some of the notes for that. I remember working on it in 1979. All right, is there a last question? I think we're about out of time, but does anybody have any last questions? Okay, well, thanks, everybody. Thanks. I hope next time we'll see you back at the usual time, Thursday, next time, next week. So thanks very much for coming to the lecture. I'm sorry for any inconvenience. So we'll see you next week. Thanks, everybody.